welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Okay, I know it's early days, but I believe a little humor could see us nicely through the inevitable stress and strain of the holiday season. We all have so much to do, but to keep spirits bright, we need to take some time out for ourselves and settle in with a good read sprinkled with bits of levity. I've got a great selection of titles, books from comedians, even a classic comedic character reborn. Journey with us now, and you'll enjoy choices that add sparkle and shine just when you need it most. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. Billy Crystal is 65, and he's not happy about it. In Still Foolin' Him, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys, Billy outlines the absurdities and challenges that come with growing old. Funny, insightful chapters include Buying the Plot and Nodding Off. Crystal not only catalogs his physical gripes, but offers a roadmap to the 77 million fellow baby boomers who are no longer 30-something. Or 40-something. Listeners get a front-row seat to experiences like his one-day career with the New York Yankees, where he was the first player to ever test positive for Maalox, his successes on SNL, his movies, including When Harry Met Sally, and his Academy Award hosting gigs. Crystal, who narrates, offers up an unforgettable look at his extraordinary life.
March 14th, 2013, my 65th birthday. I got up that morning, padded over to the bathroom, threw some water on my face, looked in the mirror, and my Uncle Al was staring back at me. My screen brought Janice, my wife of 42 years, running in and kept yelling. Somehow, overnight, it seemed I had turned from a hip, cool baby boomer into a Diane Arbus photograph. I looked at Janice for an encouraging word, for a hug, for an, "It's okay, Billy, you look great, it's an old mirror." All she did was glance down at my robe, which had opened up, and ask, "When did your pubic hair turn gray?" It's hard to believe. Not the part about the pubic hair, or that my package now looks like Einstein with Barry Scheck's nose. It's the part about how it's really happening, and fast. As a kid, I was always drawn to the dark side of things. I knew at a young age that no one gets out of this alive. But it seemed that I had time. Back in 1961, when I was 13, I would think, in 1978, I'll be 30. Great, so far away. Then when I was 30, I thought, in 1998, I'll be 50. So far away. Now that I'm 65, I think, in the year 2038, I'll be mostly dead. Or as Miracle Max and A Princess Bride would say, slightly alive. Now, there is some comfort in knowing that there are so many of us boomers in the same boat. The truth is, very soon, the entire country is pretty much going to smell the same from Los Angeles to Maine. We're all in this together and all having the same thought. Hate this. There are 77 million of us in this age group, and with all of our diversity, we have one thing in common. Our parents were right. It all happened so fast. During the past year, I saw my dermatologist more than I saw my grandkids. Things started to grow on me where they shouldn't. My ass looks like the bottom of a boat. I don't shower anymore. I'm sandblasted twice a week. I'm always at the dermatologist. I'm like his own personal honey-baked ham. He's always picking at me. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not here to bitch and moan. Well, wait, I am here to bitch and moan. But I'm here to answer the really fundamental questions of life. Where are we as baby boomers? Where are we going? Where have we been? Did anything we do really matter? If there's an afterlife, do they have digital cable? What's next for us? Do the Yankees have enough pitching? Why does God make everything small that should be big and everything big that should be small? The whole idea of 65 is scary because I'm now closer to 70 than I am to 60. But to me, fear has always been a motivator. America's kids are plump and out of shape, but not me. Have you been to Disneyland lately? It's not a small world after all. It's a big, fat, sweaty world. I, on the other hand, eat organic food, I juice, I work out, and I take comfort in the fact that my 65 is not my grandparents' 65. When my grandfather was 65, he looked 80, and he smelled 90. Now, we all have a different image of what old is. And if you were exposed to senior citizens at a young age, as I was, and they told you, one day, you're going to look like this. It can color your soul with terror. For me, old is my grandfather coming to visit us in his Bermuda shorts hiked up to his... and wearing black socks and sandals. Terrifying. Terrifying. So I never wanted to look like that, so I pushed myself. At 60, I could do the same things I could do at 30, if I could only remember what the hell those things were. At 65, things do change quickly. For one thing, your libido slows down. You don't kid yourself and look at 25-year-olds anymore. Actually, I do, but they're out of focus, and by the time I get my glasses on, they're gone. When you're 65, you're surprised by what now turns you on. You look at Dame Edna and you think... you know what? Not that bad. At 65, when you go out to eat and tell the family that dinner is on you, you mean it literally. It's on your chin, it's on your shirt, it's on your pants. You're usually wearing more than you ate.
We've just heard Still Fooling 'Em by Billy Crystal. Readers, the incomparable Tim Conway is my guest today on The Book Report. If you check his own bio, it reads, Tim Conway was born and then did 11 years on The Carol Burnett Show. But his new book, What's So Funny, My Hilarious Life, fills you in on the parts between his birth, The Carol Burnett Show, and after. And the great thing is, when you read it, you feel as if he's there with you, sharing all those wonderful behind-the-scenes moments. Welcome, Tim. It's a thrill to have you with us on The Book Report.
Isn't it, though? My gosh, I tell you, I was saying to myself this morning, it must be a thrill to have me on.
It is. Tell us the evolution from Toma to Tom to Tim.
Yes. Well, my mother is Romanian, so my original name was Toma, T-O-M-A. And then I changed. I didn't like Tom, so Steve Allen said, why don't you just dot the O, and became Tim.
All right.
So he's actually the one that christened me.
Hmm. Okay. You wrote in the book that your parents were solid, loving, and you even write that your dad was rather silent. So where do you believe your comic genius comes from?
Myself. Okay. I was self-taught. I had dyslexia, so it was difficult for me to read in class, and my classmates always thought it was very funny that I was adding words to sentences that really weren't there. But I fortunately married another dyslexic, so we didn't have to talk much.
All right. Well, in the book's foreword, Carol Burnett lets out this juicy tidbit. You can sew like a tailor. So is this just one of your hidden talents, and what are the others?
Yes, my mother was a seamstress and made slipcovers and things like that. So I made slipcovers and jackets and things like that. And the seamstress and gardener and anything handy, you know.
Okay. You begin the book by saying, I was born to enjoy life, and I've always wanted everyone to enjoy it with me. What an amazing philosophy.
I enjoyed making people happy, so show business seemed to be the place for me. I started out to be a jockey, but at 140 pounds, even the horses ask you to get off, so I went into show business.
All right. Well, tell our listeners how Rose Marie set you on your path to stardom.
Well, she was coming through Cleveland doing some promos for the Dick Van Dyke Show. And I said, do you want to see some of the stuff we were doing here? And there was a guy on television in WEWS in Cleveland. And I would come out every morning. It was a morning movie, and I was the director of the show. And I never got the movie off at the time it was supposed to get off. So a lot of endings never came on the movie. And we actually had people writing in the papers, you know, you want to see Stink? Watch this show, because For instance, in Citizen Kane, and they said, where was the sled? And I said, you know the movie, so I don't need to show it. And we were both fired from there, and on I went into another radio station.
Hmm. Can you share some Dog Hereford memories from the Steve Allen Show?
Well, Steve was probably the brightest guy I ever met, and a fun guy.
One of your chapters is entitled The Importance of Being Ernest Borgnine. Share some stories about him.
Well, he was a marvelous, a big, jolly guy, and I'm sorry to see that he's not around here anymore, but he was a wonderful guy. If you saw Marty, that was the real Ernie Borgnine.
Hmm. Warm and wonderful. So what was it like for you to be Ensign Parker?
Well, that was my first job, really, in major TV outside of Steve Allen. And it was great because I loved working with Joe Flynn and Ernie Borgnine and the cast. And it was about the military, and I had been through the military, so I knew that there was a great deal of humor there. And the reason that they took it off is because we had done 4 years in black and white, and color was coming in, and they didn't think that they could sell the black and whites in reruns if color was in. So they took it off.
Hmm. Well, I remember watching it, and I loved it.
Yes, yeah. I did too.
Yeah. Now, you met Carol Burnett while on The Gary Moore Show, and you knew in an instant that she was someone very, very special. Can you share a favorite Carol story from those days?
Well, the first time I came in contact with Carol was when she had her own show, because she remembered me from The Gary Moore Show, and she said, I would like you to come on the show. And I said, well, how many shows do you want me to do? And she said, well, we do 33 a year. And she said, well, I'd like you to do all of them. And I said, well, I'd have to have the last week off in case I guessed somewhere. And she said, well, okay. And so I did 32 shows. And then the last week, I would be a guest on her show. So I ended up doing 33, really.
All right. Now, tell us a little about Harvey Korman. I also loved how much you described his dressing. Talk about that.
Well, he used to take the wardrobe home from any show that he was on. And it was always ill-fitting, and he was always standing on a corner somewhere with one pant leg with the hem out, because he would take it right off the rack.
Can you share a little about when you and Harvey actually had lunch with Cary Grant?
Yes. Harvey was eating and spilling everything, as he always did, all over his shirt and everything. And he looked at Cary Grant, and Cary Grant was just taking a spoon of soup, and he spilled just a drop on his pants. And Harvey said, oh, you spilled too. And they were nothing alike. Cary Grant was the alpha, and Harvey was the omega of
right
dressing. Yeah.
And you and Carol kind of did everything in your power to make him crack up. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Very poor performer was Harvey. And, yeah, he often prided himself on the fact that he never broke up. So that was my target every week.
All right. Well, my brother's an endodontist, and he wants you to know how much he loved your famous, famous dentist skit.
Well, that actually happened for real. The dentist was working on me, and he was going to give me Novocaine, and he stuck the needle in my cheek on the inside, and it went through my cheek and into his own thumb. So he kind of paralyzed himself there, and from that, we did the dentist sketch.
All right. Well, tell us about your glory days as a jockey.
Well, they weren't so glorious. I was in the starting gate one morning, and I was way overweight for a jockey. But the guy said, you know, get that horse in here, put him in the gate. And I had never been in a starting gate before, so he said, are you ready, kid? And I said, yeah, hang on just a minute. And in the meantime, he opened the gate, and the horse went out. And I was sitting there on the ground looking at this horse going down the track and thinking to myself, gosh, I wish I was on that horse. So that was the beginning of my racing career.
But then you actually went on to be an owner.
Yes. I had several horses out in California, and that's why I'm working again.
All right. Well, in the book you write, you were born to enjoy life, and it seems you're just doing that. Apart from the book, what's next in your career?
Probably to read the book, actually.
Well, I've so enjoyed our conversation. Any final thoughts?
Keep smiling, and hopefully I'll have an opportunity to continue entertaining you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today,
okay.
Readers. This was a fabulously entertaining book. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
And now let's listen to a sample of What's So Funny, My Hilarious Life, performed by Tim Conway, Carol Burnett, and Dick Hill.
I've written books with a number of celebrities. Each experience was special, and yet I never enjoyed working with anyone as much as I enjoyed working with Tim. He is a unique combination of a genuinely funny man and a real old-fashioned gentleman, at once bold as brass and at the same time disarmingly humble. There isn't a sanctimonious bone among all his funny ones. He never boasts about his accomplishments. And that's precisely why I'm using this preface to say things about him, things the reader should know, that he'd never say about himself. So here goes. At our first meeting in Los Angeles, Tim came to my hotel. The front desk called to say he was on his way up. I went into the hallway to wait for him. The elevator was at the opposite end of the corridor. In the middle of the hallway, a man wearing headphones was vacuuming. Tim stepped out of the elevator at the same moment the cleaning man left the vacuum running in the center of the hallway and turned to dust a side table. Tim started down the corridor. He reached the upright vacuum and, without breaking stride, grabbed the handle with one hand and, waving to me with the other, called out, "I'll be right there, just have to finish my work." He put his head down and began to vacuum. The cleaning man, oblivious to what was happening, thanks to his headphones, finished dusting and turned around to recover his vacuum, only to discover Tim pushing it around. For a moment, the man looked befuddled. Then he got it. He smiled and gingerly tapped Tim on the shoulder. Immediately, Tim dropped the vacuum and threw himself against the wall with his arms spread above his head, waiting to be frisked. That's when I learned that Tim Conway seizes any opportunity to amuse. Moreover, he is as delighted to make one or two people laugh as he is to entertain huge audiences. Shenanigans aside, Tim is a really grounded person. For one thing, he's had the same friends for decades. Although their names read like a who's who of Emmy and Oscar winners, they, like Tim, are down-to-earth people leading normal lives in the abnormal world of show business. And here's another Hollywood anomaly. Tim's second marriage to Charlene Beatty has been going strong for nearly 3 decades. It's a match made in heaven. But it took Tim 1 divorce and Charlene 2 to find that out. They play off each other brilliantly. If you ask Tim what Charlene's father did for a living, he'll say he was a bookie. Ask Charlene the question, and she'll tell you her father was a trumpet player who performed with big bands until they went out of fashion. He still had to earn a living, and the only other thing he knew was betting the horses. My father was a musician for most of his life, says Charlene with a laugh, but my husband calls him a bookie because it sounds funnier. Charlene and Tim Conway are their own reality show, with Charlene providing the reality. She's his leveler, the straight man who keeps him honest. Tim knows what a difference Charlene has made in his life and finds ample opportunities to acknowledge it. While receiving one of his many awards, Tim stood at the podium and thanked everyone for the honor. "I wouldn't be standing in front of you right now," he said, "if it weren't for the way my wife looks out for me. She takes charge of everything, including my diet. She's been feeding me so much fiber, I'm now passing wicker furniture." Tim's fundamentally a cheerful person, yet he has a reflective side. A quiet wisdom informs his art and his life. The right comic conditions, however, will always conquer any guardedness, and he becomes totally playful.
That was What's So Funny by Tim Conway with Jane Scovell. Winner of 12 Emmys and one Grammy Award, Carl Reiner once again brandishes his talents to tell the story of his life in I Remember Me. Reiner, who performs the book, reminisces about 90 years of highs and lows, mistakes and triumphs. I Remember Me weaves an American tapestry of colorful tales, beginning with the musings of a young boy in the Bronx, to French lessons with Mel Brooks, to a surprise early morning visit from the McCarthy-era FBI. Readers are treated to fascinating insights into his incredible successes on TV and the big screen.
On January 25th of this year, 2011, I received a letter from a Jill Fiorella who informed me that she was the granddaughter of Yetta and Max Fishman, who 85 years ago resided in the Bronx at 665 East 179th Street on the same floor as my parents, Irving and Bessie Reiner. I remembered the Fishmans. They resided in the apartment across the hall and had a son, Murray, who was my very first playmate. I learned from Ms. Fiorella's letter that Murray had passed on a few years earlier, and she thought I might like to have an item she had found among Murray's papers. In sorting through some of Murray's papers, Ms. Fiorella wrote, I came across his bar mitzvah speech. It was written so eloquently in such a beautiful handwriting, I knew at once that Murray could not have written it, and asked my mom if she knew who had. And she said that it was written by their neighbor, your father, Irving Reiner. I am enclosing a copy of the speech, hoping that it will bring back some fond memories of your childhood. Sincerely, Jill Fiorella. Ms. Fiorella could not have imagined the memories that flooded back, and they were more than just fond ones. They were revelatory. As soon as I glanced at the enclosure, I knew exactly what it was, and I was amazed and delighted to have it. In my wildest dreams, I could not have imagined that this document existed. Ms. Fiorella correctly assumed that it was the speech my father had written for her father to read at his bar mitzvah, which I learned from a sloppily scribbled date on the back, was held on June 26, 1937. What Jill Fiorello could not know was that the speech her brother made on his 13th birthday was the very same speech I had delivered at my bar mitzvah 1 year earlier. The first two words of the speech, "Worthy Assembly," had been emblazoned in my memory. At the time, I remembered thinking how really classy those words were. I had never before heard anyone address a group by saying, "Worthy Assembly," and haven't since. The rest of the speech was as flowery as its penmanship. Ms. Fiorello described my father's handwriting as being so beautiful, and I concur. Among other things, Pop was a master engraver, and the old English lettering he used was replete with curlicues and fancy swirls. As far as I knew, my father had never been a member of a synagogue or ever set foot in one. He was a believer in the Almighty, but not a joiner. A week before my big day, my father visited the Hughes Avenue Synagogue, an unprepossessing house of worship that was located in one of the Bronx's less affluent neighborhoods. For a nominal fee, the elders agreed to allow my father, a non-member, to rent their shul for a Thursday morning bar mitzvah. That morning, at 8 a.m., gathered in the synagogue were my father, my mother, my older brother Charlie, and 10 old Jewish strangers. These mostly bearded men in long prayer shawls were approximately the same wizened group who 4 years earlier had witnessed my brother's coming of age. Here now, in my father's handwriting, is the short, flowery speech that both my brother and I, and later Murray Fishman, delivered on the day we became men.
That was I Remember Me by Carl Reiner. Thought today's show would just be about comedic icons, meaning guys well over 50, may I present Rob Delaney, mother, wife, sister, human, warrior falcon, yardstick, turban, cabbage. Rob Delaney is a father, a husband, a comedian, a writer. He is the author of an endless stream of beautiful, insane jokes on Twitter. He is sometimes brave and sometimes speaks French. He has bungee jumped off the Manhattan Bridge. He enjoys antagonizing political figures, powerful retailers, and the Kardashians. And for that, we thank him. Let's see what this unusually titled book is all about. The author narrates.
At the time I signed up for Twitter, I was in debt and adding to it every month. I was submitting my writing to TV shows, hoping to get a job as a writer. I would consistently get replies with comments like, "Great stuff," but no show actually hired me. Other comics were publicly expressing worry about giving up their material for free on Twitter, but since nobody was paying me to do much of anything, with the exception of the saintly owners of the aforementioned joke joint in Minneapolis, the only club in the country that would book me a couple times a year to headline, I figured, I'll give it away for free. I decided to show the people who were kind enough to become my Twitter followers that, whether or not they necessarily thought I was funny, I had a work ethic and liked to write jokes all day, every day. I had also cultivated a somewhat relaxed philosophy about my own intellectual property. Some years before, I'd had the good fortune to have a joke stolen from me and performed on TV by a comic I knew. I was upset at first, but then I realized that, poor etiquette aside, the guy was funny and he would have been on TV with or without my joke. I also realized that if I couldn't immediately write several more jokes to replace it, then I wasn't funny, and I had no business calling myself a comedian. So I forced myself to make a mental adjustment, and I decided that the guy had done me a giant favor. And he had. I became much less precious about material. Of course, I'd be proud of a good joke, but I knew that I just had to continue producing material. My silent motto when people started stealing my jokes on Twitter was, "Go ahead and take them. Here come five more." My goal as a comedian was to become a Delta Force operator of humor who you could throw into an empty room with nothing and he'd make something funny and then kill people with it. This remains my goal today. On Twitter, I try to elicit an emotional response. Usually it's laughter. Hopefully it's involuntary. I don't fault people for posting pictures of their food or just chatting back and forth with one another. That's just not my style. People come to my page to be entertained, and I view it as my sworn duty to do so. In December of 2010, a woman named Julie Grau tweeted to me, "Would you please write me a book?" I wrote back, "I'd love to," and immediately forgot about it. The next day, I got an email from my friend, the author Matt Johnson, who said I might give this friendly stranger's tweet a little more attention, as she was responsible for publishing a respectable percentage of the best books being written today. I went to the bathroom in my pants, figuratively, and wrote Ms. Grau back, telling her it would be my sincere pleasure to write her a book, and I asked how I might go about beginning the process formally. I also told her I happened to have a show coming up in New York. I did not. If she'd like to meet and discuss further. After that email, I scrambled to book a show in New York and bought a plane ticket. After meeting Julie and her team in New York, I returned to L.A., and my wife and I prepared to greet our first child, who was nearly done ripening in her belly. One day, while I was sitting in a McDonald's parking lot, staring at a wall and contemplating fatherhood, Julie called and formally offered me a book deal. I said thank you, then hung up and started crying. A few days later, our son was born.
We've just heard Rob Delaney by Rob Delaney. As a young kid growing up in a farm town, wishing for a pet unicorn might have been more realistic for Ross Matthews than achieving his real dream, working in TV in Hollywood. That stuff just doesn't happen to people like Ross, but it did. Now, in Man Up, Tales of My Delusional Self-Confidence, Ross takes us inside his journey, revealing the most embarrassing and hilarious moments of his small-town life and big-city adventures. Ross, who narrates, shares how he managed to turn an obsession with pop culture into one-on-one interactions with celebrities like Gwyneth Paltrow and Madonna without ever having a single restraining order issued against him. Infused with Ross's trademark humor, Man Up is a mission statement for anyone who doesn't fit the mold.
Balloon Day was awesome. That rare occasion that appealed to naive kindergartners and jaded sixth graders alike. But as excited as all my classmates were for Balloon Day, my unapologetic gusto put them to shame. This event spoke to me. I loved not only the pageantry of it, but the symbolism as well, and my unbridled enthusiasm for it bordered on straight-up bonkers. But unlike the time I farted on the slide during recess in front of a group of popular fourth graders, none of my peers seemed to judge my boyhood balloon obsession too harshly, for they too loved Balloon Day. Here's how the big day went down. On small pieces of paper, no bigger than Tootsie Pop wrappers, my classmates and I would write our most heartfelt wishes, thoughts, and feelings. Each time my school celebrated Balloon Day, my personalized note was slightly different, but my penmanship was always immaculate. I took the process very seriously, treating it like a sacred communication between myself and the great unknown. In addition to my most private and profound thoughts, I'd also take the opportunity to humbly ask for a few actual gifts. Hey, it couldn't hurt, right? You never know. In second grade, I begged the universe for a pony farm. In fourth grade, I yearned for a pony farm and a donut factory. And finally, in sixth grade, I insisted on a pony farm, a donut factory, and for reasons I didn't quite understand yet, TV's Jonathan Taylor Thomas. Each time I would include my parents' home telephone number and end my message with, "If you find this note, please call me." Once the notes were written, the next and most important step of all was picking out our balloons. In the early days of kindergarten, I made the rookie mistake of being a gentleman, allowing all the girls in school to choose their balloon colors before I chose mine. It was a chivalrous gesture, equivalent to putting my coat over a mud puddle for a darling damsel in distress, but it left me with a pathetically pitiful color palette of balloons from which to choose. An orange balloon? I don't think so. I'm a spring, not a fall, thank you very much. I should have known better. Elementary school girls are as cutthroat as they are cute. Never again. By first grade, I was a seasoned pro. When it came to grabbing the best balloon of the bunch, it was survival of the fittest. With my kindergarten mistakes behind me, I now knew to shamelessly shove my way through the throng of annoying adolescent little ladies in order to reach the basket of uninflated balloons before those could steal all the pink ones, my signature color then and now. After we selected our balloons, they were filled with helium and attached to our super-secret messages with a string by our gym teacher, a major hottie who looked like a cross between He-Man and Barbie's boyfriend Ken. Hubba hubba. Finally, the entire student body would march onto the grassy fields behind the gymnasium with our balloons bobbing over our heads like multicolored thought bubbles. "Hold on tight, kids," the teacher's aide would remind us. "Don't let go until we're all together." What a well-meaning idiot, bless her heart. Of course I was going to hold on to my balloon, dum-dum. Woman, please. We were all in this together, and if I let go early, I would ruin Balloon Day for everyone. That wasn't going to happen, lady. Not on my watch. So I held onto that string with my fat little sausage-like prepubescent fingers with the same protective fervor with which I held my turkey and cheddar Lunchable. I'll admit, it was tempting to let go and give my message a head start, but I fought the urge. "Okay, everybody," my principal shouted, causing my heart to beat even faster. I knew what was coming next, and it was by far, without a doubt, the absolute highlight of my entire year. "Count it down with me, kids. 1, 2, 3. In unison, we unclenched our hands, loosened our grips, and released our balloons en masse into the air. It was, at that point in my young life, the most beautiful thing I had ever seen, short of Jonathan Taylor Thomas. A sea of red, blue, yellow, green, orange, and pink balloons danced gracefully, intermingling and drifting higher and higher into the blue sky, each one carrying the precious cargo of children's wishes. We watched them, transfixed, until they shrank to the size of Skittles and eventually disappeared beyond the horizon.
That was Man Up by Ross Matthews. Kevin Pollak rose through the comedy club ranks at the feet of Don Rickles, Bill Cosby, Johnny Carson, and George Carlin. Named one of Comedy Central's top 100 stand-up comedians of all time, he's a killer impressionist, a versatile actor, and an internet pioneer. He's done it all, and now he's ready to spill the beans in How I Slept My Way to the Middle, secrets and stories from stage, screen, and interwebs. Ballsy, hilarious, and revealing, the book, written with Alan Goldsher and performed by Kevin, combines stories about A-list entertainers with Kevin's thoughts about how he made it. He turned down his first invitation to do stand-up on The Tonight Show because he knew he'd make a bigger splash if he sat on the couch next to Johnny. That was a huge risk, which paid off, and that was just the beginning. Find out how he brought John Belushi to his knees, tortured Paul Reiser, bamboozled Larry King, and almost killed Warren Beatty. Now a new media entrepreneur, Kevin is laughing proof that if you follow your gut and believe in yourself, you just might be able to do anything you want.
Throughout my life, kidhood, adulthood, and ever in betweenhood, I've done some nervy things that today I often explain as taking life by the reins and creating my own destiny. In other words, I've done some crazy shit and it paid off beyond any conceivable expectations. One of my earliest nutty moves happens when I'm 17. I buy tickets to see master impressionist Rich Little at the Circle Star Theater, a revered venue in San Carlos, just south of San Francisco, the city of my birth, and about 30 minutes north of San Jose, where I still lived with my parents. The Circle Star is famous for having a revolving stage that's conducive to almost nothing. Still, it was a big part of my young life, as witnessed by the infamous Dave Clark 5 autograph session. At that point, I'd been working on impersonations of Marlon Brando, Cary Grant, President Richard Nixon, and Peter Falk's Lieutenant Columbo character, among others, for the previous couple of years. After seeing Rich Little perform on The Tonight Show, I know that when it comes to impersonating celebrity voices, Rich Little is beyond the man. David Fry's Nixon album is truly brilliant, and Frank Gorshin and Godfrey Cambridge have small stable of famous voices they could do well, as did John Biner. But Little has no equal, and he's an enormous influence on my early work. For example, one of my favorite voices to emulate is Johnny Carson, but even though I'm a Tonight Show fanatic, the basis of my impression comes from, not Johnny, but Rich. Author's note. Dana Carvey, who came up the comedy ranks in San Francisco at the same time I did, and who does a mean Johnny Carson himself, also used Rich Little's Johnny as his template. So in a sense, at the beginning of our careers, we were both impersonating Rich Little impersonating Johnny Carson. Ask anyone who does solid impersonations, and they will acknowledge someone else as being the one who cracked it first. Even my William Shatner impression, which became the template for countless other Shatners, was inspired by my seeing John Belushi's version on Saturday Night Live. Even though when you Google Christopher Walken impersonation, my name comes up on top, the first guy I saw do Walken was Jay Moore. While I was honing my Walken, I begged Jay for helpful tips, to which he said, When doing walk-in, every one-syllable word becomes a two-syllable word. So no becomes now. I remember hearing Jay mention on the great serious radio show Opie and Anthony that his walk-in was inspired by a comic named Roger Kabler. Anyway, Rich Little's gig at the Circle Star Theater is my first live comedy show, and I'm excited beyond words. But I use the word comedy here loosely because Rich Little wasn't known as a hilarious comedian. Even at 17, I realized that the man is a brilliant technician, but his routines, not so much. His lack of material inspires me to perfect a few jokes of my own. Humor, or lack thereof, aside, Rich is a hero, and weeks before I attend his show, I decide that I need my hero to glimpse my talent somehow. Suddenly, it's absolutely crucial that he learn of my existence. The question becomes, how? How am I going to show the great and powerful Rich Little that I'm talented? Then, as is the case with many of my nervous moves, the answer comes to me out of the ozone. My favorite celebrity to impersonate is Peter Falk. My mother and I watch his TV series Columbo religiously. Early in season one of its 13-year run, I remember trying to imitate Falk's masterful yet seemingly bumbling detective. During a commercial break, I head to the kitchen to pick up what my mother believes is some kind of treat, but I come back instead with a stubby pencil, a dark pencil, in my hand, pretending it's Columbo's ever-present stub of a smoking cigar. I say to my mom, excuse me, ma'am. I don't mean to be a pest. It's just that, well, may I say that the pork chops at supper earlier this evening were absolutely delicious. She howls at my impression, and I never look back.
That was a sample of How I Slept My Way to the Middle by Kevin Pollak. Bertie Wooster, a young man about town, and his butler Jeeves, the very model of the modern manservant, return in their first new novel in nearly 40 years, Jeeves and the Wedding Bells, the first authorized addition to the beloved P.G. Wodehouse series. Wodehouse documented the lives of the inimitable Jeeves and Wooster for nearly 60 years, from their first appearance in 1915 to the final completed novel in 1974. These two were the creations of a novelist widely proclaimed to be the finest comic writer of the English language. Now Sebastian Falk takes his turn with these lovely characters. Bertie, nursing a bit of heartbreak over the recent engagement of one Georgina Meadows to someone not named Wooster, agrees to help his old friend Peregrine Woody Beeching, whose own romance is foundering. This means an outing to Dorset, away from an impending visit from Aunt Agatha. Almost immediately, things go awry, and the simple plan becomes oh so complicated. Jeeves ends up impersonating one Lord Etchingham, while Bertie pretends to be Jeeves' manservant, Wilberforce. From there, the plot becomes hilariously convoluted, a work worthy of the master himself. Julian Rind Tutt performs the book.
Easing the person to an even semi-recumbent position caused pains to shoot across the small of the back. Whoever had designed the palliasse on which I had lain these 7 hours had clearly been of the opinion that nature's sweet restorer, as I have heard Jeeves call it, can get the job done in 5-minute bursts. It required a steadying grip on the bedstead before I could cross the bare boards and don the dressing gown. It's possible that a sharp-eared observer might have heard a few groans as, sponge bag in hand, I headed down the passageway towards the servants' bathroom. Mercifully, I seemed to be the first to the ablutions. Hot water came from a geyser in a boiling trickle over the bath, but in the basin, the H and C taps might more accurately have been labelled cold and frozen. It was a haggard Bertram who stared back from the glass as he plied the morning steel and sponged the outlying portions. I dried off with a strip of material less like a towel than a yard of well-used sandpaper. It's funny how quickly one gets used to certain things in life. At school, we had been compelled, on pain of six of the juiciest, to keep a keen eye on our kit and know at all times whether socks, grey, six pairs, and footer bags, navy blue, two pairs, were to be found. The services of Tucker, my accommodating scout at Oxford, however, and several years of Jeeves's care, had left me rather vague in such matters. To say it was something of a trial to dress myself in the uniform of a gentleman's personal gentleman would be an understatement. Eventually, after several attempts and some pretty fruity language, the shirt, collar stud, and tie achieved some sort of coming together, after which the outer garments were a breeze. Pausing only to rub the shoe on the back of the trouser, I went gingerly out onto the landing and down the back staircase, which gave off a powerful whiff of limewood. There was a lengthy passageway that led to the kitchens. I pushed at the double doors and entered the cook's domain with as near as I could manage to a spring in the step. To fill the kettle and bung it on the range was the work of an instant. The problems began with an attempt to locate pot, tea leaves, milk, and so forth. I had never previously paused to think just how many items go into the making of the morning cupful. I opened a hopeful-looking cupboard to be confronted by a variety of what may have been fish kettles. I pushed off into the scullery, where I spied a bottle of milk with a paper twist. A quick sniff established that it was not of recent origin, and I was beginning to feel that I was not cut out for this sort of thing when I heard footsteps outside. Fearing the cook, Mrs. Paget, would not take kindly to an intruder, I made as if to exit towards the dining room. But to my surprise, it was the housekeeper, Mrs. Tilman. "Mr. Wilberforce, goodness, you are the early bird."
"Yes, what ho! A lot of worms to catch, don't you know?
I was just looking for the tea leaves." "Are you taking up tea for Lord Etringham? Isn't it a bit early?"
7 o'clock was what he told me."
"I think 7:30's quite soon enough. Why don't you get on with some shoe cleaning, and let me make the tea in a moment?" "Goodness me, you've put enough water in the kettle for a regiment of soldiers. Off you go down to the butler's pantry. You'll find polish in the cupboard. And you brought down Lord Etringham's shoes last night, didn't you?"
"I did indeed, two pairs of them."
I left the tea-making in the hands of this excellent woman and got down to some spit-and-polish work on the black Oxfords and the brown brogues, size 8, that I had scooped up the night before. In my experience, the butler's pantry, in addition to corkscrews, candles, and other odd bits of chandlery, often holds a bottle or two of the right stuff. But it was too early in the morning, even for a constitution as strong as mine. The thought, however, bucked me up a little. I wouldn't say that a song rose to the Worcester lips as I worked, but I went about the buffing and shining with a certain gusto. When I returned to the kitchen, I found that Mrs. Tilman had laid a tray with all the fixings. "Oh, dear, look at you, Mr. Wilberforce. You didn't put on your apron, did you? You've got polish on your shirt. Here, let me." With a cloth, she removed most of a black smear from the affected area, and, with the coat rebuttoned, she seemed to think I was ready for action.
We've just heard Jeeves and the Wedding Bells by Sebastian Falks. Reading recipes, reading shopping lists, reading the paper for coupons? This is not the kind of reading relaxation you need at this time of year. To be at your brightest, remember to take time out for yourself. I hope you found some titles today that might entice you to find a quiet corner with a book that will make you smile, even laugh out loud. Book Report Radio has more suggestions, plus gift ideas for those hard-to-please folks on your list. Thanks for joining us today. You hang in there, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.